Welcome to the Ed Show. This is number 83, I do believe. And who the heck are you, man?
My name is Joey Snow. I just came out of my DeLorean, and I'm here on the show now.
Wait a second. You don't have the right accent for Joey Snow. You're definitely tall enough, and you've got good hair, but I still will give Joey points for the hair. Your hair's not quite as good.
But I disagree.
This is my good friend Anthony Bartolo, who's actually down for MVP Summit. He's a Microsoft employee based out of Canada. Doing technical evangelism, infrastructure
yep.
stuff,
infrastructure
Windows
stuff.
Client stuff.
BYOD stuff.
And I said, hey, I've got some news items that are probably going to be right up your alley if you want to talk about them, and why don't you come and co-host a show with me?
I thank you for the invite, and happy to be here.
Fantastic. Well, let's get right started with a little bit of the news. First up, I want to share with you is a blog post that actually went live last week, so it's still a little bit recent as far as what you should be looking at. The Microsoft Hybrid Cloud Overview. It's on the Brad Anderson in the cloud blog, where he talks specifically about our approach to how we handle hybrid cloud. So not just a all or nothing approach to what you would have with most public cloud offerings like an Amazon solution as an example. This is where you're able to, in case you don't already know this, have infrastructure as a service up in Azure as an example, tie that down into your own corporate networking infrastructures of your private cloud area, and basically burst out and scale out very simply and easily. This is something we've been able to do for a while now.
You know, and it's a great way for IT professionals to take advantage of the cloud
yeah.
because the security mechanisms that are in play right, enable for that secure connection and robustness of scaling out your operations when it's required.
Yeah, I mean, you have your secure VPN between the two points, and you have the ability now with 2012 and 2012 R2 server to be able to make those VPN connections without having to have dedicated hardware, fully supported, and allows you to scale out certain workloads, keep the rest of them inside your own data center, your own brick and mortar. I know that's important to some countries yep. from a data amnesty perspective.
Yep.
So that's our approach to how we do it. And actually, we're getting some very good press about this, both with, I was just going to say, TechCrunch has been talking about this, about how our approach is different than how we do it with Amazon and their side of things, and also simply other players like the other virtualization providers, starts with V, ends in E.
I thought ends in scare.
their approach also, just they don't have the robustness of the full offering of public stuff and also private stuff on premise that we do. So I encourage you to take a look at this blog post. I'll have the link included with the show. Brad Anderson's blog is quite good. He's also backed it up with some good engineering posts as well over the last little while, so check that one out.
Very cool.
Next up on the list, this is something, again, a little bit interesting. I'm very excited. This week we have the Xbox One
Woo-hoo!
Releasing. I know that my kids don't watch the show, so I can say that I've possibly pre-ordered something to make sure that I get one in the Claus household. But there's actually a smart glass app was just released for Xbox One. Talk to me a little bit about this, man.
So what's really cool about the smart glass app now for the Xbox One, it's the same functionality where you had the ability to control the Xbox One in terms of gameplay and functionality around media. But mm-hmm. now it extends to your set-top box.
Okay.
So in controlling what you are wanting to watch in terms of live content, also being controlled from the smart glass app, as well as the availability to show off, you know, your high scores in terms of games in regards to the DVR playback. So the ability to record content and then be able to view it via smart glass on your device, whether that be tablet or phone.
That's absolutely awesome. I know that this is something that has been revealed and talked about in the past with different types of exposés and discussion around the Xbox interface and that sort of stuff. It's not really IT pro related, but
nope.
hey, we're
it's
all gamers
cool.
and geeks out there as well, so I figured, hey, we'd cover this here.
I think it shows a perfect mix between, you know, personal life and work life in terms of BYOD, right, and how devices now blend between both worlds in terms of utilization.
I like how you tied that one in there. It's perfect. Now, I know that this is something you're passionate
yes.
about on mobile devices. In case you don't know, his Twitter handle is @wirelesslife. And in his previous lives, he's done other stuff around mobility. Obviously, is one
yep.
of the things you're pretty passionate about.
Yep.
But this week, we had some new announcements coming off from Nokia. Is it Nokia? The proper way to say it?
Nokia is the proper way to say it. That's for the Europeans that are out there. They're all thanking you for doing it properly.
So what? what's the hot devices that have been announced and are being released this
so
week?
So the hot devices that are coming out this week, the 1520.
Okay.
So for people of your age, there's a bigger screen.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
So the bigger screen now allows you, obviously, in 1080p, fully viewable, beautiful Super AMOLED
yep.
color just comes off the screen. Quad-core processor, 16 or 32 gigs of storage, 2 gigs of RAM.
Yep.
This thing is going to be the most powerful Windows phone to date in market.
Very cool.
When it comes out. Alongside with that, the 2520. So Nokia is now dabbling into the tablet market.
Is that the phablet?
No, so the phablet is actually the 1650.
Okay.
And that is the, the 1520.
You got it.
Keep going. So the phablet is actually the 1520 because that's a mobile OS.
Okay.
And the 2520 is actually the tablet. So that will be running Windows RT opposed to phone.
Yeah.
So the main difference is between the two. The interesting piece with the Nokia, the 2520, it will have the embedded 4G radio. So it will have the LTE stack for connectivity seamlessly made available now in Windows 8.1.
Very cool. So those ones are definitely out. But there's also something else that you talked about me. You talked with me on the way down to the studio today. What is this?
So it's the upgrade that's coming out. So it's currently out on the lower end phones, so the 520, 620, 621. The ability to have Bluetooth 4.0 capability. So that's a low energy consumption availability.
And this capability was inside the devices already?
Inside the devices already.
Didn't have drivers?
Didn't have the drivers. It wasn't made available in the current offering. It was made available on the Amber update on the lower end Nokia devices in the last update. And on the upcoming Nokia Black update, we'll have the full functionality for the higher end devices.
Okay.
So as an example, it'll connect to devices that connect over low energy. So at your age, your pacemaker that you haven't solved can be connected via the phone, and you can actually get the vitals on the device.
I don't have to ask you back, you realize.
No. We'll just do this in Canada. Yeah. No, I'm joking.
So it now will have Bluetooth support.
Yes.
Low energy Bluetooth 4 profile.
It helps on battery consumption, and it helps on connecting to devices that support low energy connectivity.
So obviously it has to have apps that are aware of the fact
that
Bluetooth 4, and the devices you're connected to have to obviously have Bluetooth 4 profile.
Correct.
As well. So that's no hardware change, simply driver update.
It's a driver update,
and it'll be available,
which will be available soon.
Very cool. Quick little change here for this one is, I saw this one here from, I saw this announced by Ben the PC guy.
Ben the PC guy.
He announced this one here on Monday of this week, talking about the ability to have Microsoft Office presentations controlled by your Windows phone. So basically, it is a Bluetooth tethering to your laptop, an add-in you have to install on Office 2013, and then an app you install on your Windows Phone device that allows you to have interaction between your desktop, laptop, and your phone device to be able to control. For instance, the most common example he used was PowerPoints, Notes, laser pointer, and that sort of stuff, slide advancer and backwards, that sort of stuff.
Yep.
That one there is one that he was talking about, but it also has interaction with also Excel and Word and PowerPoint. And this was part of a collaboration I had with Microsoft Research to be able to do this one. It's not final, it's a pre-release, if you will, just like an RC, if you will, for functionality, and more functionalities to come. I encourage you to check that one out.
And can you imagine that functionality on the 1520 with the 6-inch screen?
Even better.
You know, and you can actually see your notes when you're doing your presentation, as opposed to squinting on some of the smaller screens, right?
You got it. I like that. It's very, very cool.
Really cool.
The last one is a update to an application I talked about when I had one of the product managers from Windows Server Essentials on the show a couple of episodes back. Where he's talking about the My Server app. The My Server app is available, downloadable in the Windows Phone App Store, which allows you to go in and to interoperate and to talk with and manage and view resources on your Windows Server Essentials 2011 devices. The new version is now available for 2012 and 2012 R2 for full functionality. So you can basically manage accounts, you can go off and access files, you can go off and browse media content, sort of stuff, all remotely to your system, provided you have remote access set up to your Windows Essentials install in 2012 R2 available remotely. You can access that anywhere you want to on your phone as long as you have internet connectivity.
It's interesting how we're in a paradigm now where information is accessed from any device, and there's no way or how being stopped accessing that information. And the further enablement through applications or through the browser or what have you are allowing you to aggregate that content from any place.
So your device, any data, as long as it's accessible,
correct,
you get any device you want, your preferences follow you around, the way you want to work with your data follows you around, and it's securely managed.
Yes.
You got it. Don't forget about that. My technical interview after this is actually, it's still not recorded yet, I'm still working on getting that one done. That's going to actually be with a friend of mine named Corey Hines from HOL Systems. They're the people that go off and actually provide you with the back-end experience of talking to TechNet VLabs to be able to go off and to try different technologies. Windows Server 2012 R2, System Center 2012 R2, all in a virtualized environment in their data center out of Florida. I'm going to have him here doing a whiteboard discussion around how that's set up, how that works, and you can go off and try it yourself. So stick around. Corey's coming up after the break. All
I just managed to snag Corey Hines. Your official title, do you have a title with HOL Systems?
I guess I'm the lead architect.
Lead architect for HOL Systems. And for those of you who don't know, HOL Systems is the company that currently looks after providing the infrastructure dynamically to launch off TechNet VLABs.
Absolutely. Well, TechNet MSDN and MSDN.
Yeah.
And all the internal conferences and TechEd and everything else under the sun.
So you know a little thing about virtualization, how to deploy machines very quickly and infrastructure to be able to support this.
A little bit, although, you know, when you did say, come over, you didn't say, let's sit on a sofa with a bright light in our face in a corner in a building.
It's very natural.
At 5:30 in the evening.
It's very natural. So he just finished wrapping up a two-day immersive jumpstart with Simon Perryman talking about day one was virtualization and Hyper-V. Day two was all system center. So he's a little brain fried right now. But I figured, hey, let's go off and give me a little bit of an exploration of what is the VLABs, very quick and simple. And more importantly, I want to know the infrastructure behind it and how it runs and what makes it tick.
You're a server geek, so you want to know
how I want all the fun connected gluey stuff in the back end works.
Well, so first of all, this here is obviously the VLABs landing page. So you come in here and you know, they've got a catalog that presents all these different lab environments, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's somewhere in the order of 300 of these things now.
Okay.
Actually, no, 480 of these things. And every one of these is, you know, like a little mini service, right? So you've got a bunch of VMs connected by networks that we need to be able to provision on demand across a farm of Hyper-V servers.
And you have no idea, based on the time of day, what flavor of the moment wants to go off and launch them.
Yeah, it's completely random. But at the same time, we've got to be able to control it, to be able to guarantee certain levels of service, different things of that nature. And so we've had to go out and basically build our own solution for all of this, build our own software. Because, you know, this scenario isn't addressed by any commercial product right now.
So when you launch one of these things...
This is essentially the what you get right here. You get a little UI with a bunch of windows, and in each of these windows is different VMs that are connected. So this right here is an instance of a lab that has four VMs in it.
Okay. And obviously named DC, Server 1, Server 2.
Right, they're all connected by their own individual sort of private network connection between them.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you start labs, let's go... take this work folder one right here. As you click on it and spin it up, just kind of give that one a whirl. It goes out and starts the application and then creates the creates the lab for you, and then you'll see what this little tool here is doing in the background.
Oh, yeah.
This is the tool that we built. It actually goes out and begins to open all the different VMs in the background. So if I get this one back here. So you can see it start to open these individual VMs. And this is, you know, cycling through them pretty quickly. It's actually creating the VMs that quick.
Okay.
So it's creating them on the fly, and there's the VMs right there.
Once again. And this is hit anywhere in the world. Anyone can hit this, can launch a variety of types of labs. And they have, like this one here says 120 minutes remaining. Basically, they have, I saw one of the other windows has like a lab document. They can step through stuff. They can choose to do that, or they can just use it as like a little bit of a sandbox.
Yeah. So there's like the lab manual with the actual instructions. You just scroll through and it says, you know, hey, on certain VMs, do certain things. And that's a lab, right?
Okay.
It's a very structured set of things. When you're done, you hit exit, pulls up an evaluation for you, and then you complete the evaluation. Skip from my example right here. And at that point, the VMs are all destroyed. They're gone.
Okay.
So we go in and delete them behind the scenes. And so you're probably kind of wondering, you know, well, how do you do all of that?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'll kind of show you at a conceptual level what goes on initially. So first of all, we have, you know, obviously we have the concept of a cloud of lab capacity. And we've got lots and lots of these different clouds of lab capacity within our data center.
Mm-hmm.
And these clouds are assigned to run across farms of Hyper-V servers. So we've got racks and racks and racks and racks of Hyper-V servers anywhere from, I think the smallest ones are 256 gig up to anywhere to up to like 512 gigs of RAM. You'll pardon my writing on the surface.
It's all right. You're doodling. That's why we try to do this, right?
I'm not the best with, you know, writing to begin with. and so we take these clouds of capacity and we just allocate them across servers. And within this cloud of capacity, we're able to define things like, you know, how many users can be on there at any point in time.
Mm-hmm.
How many copies of a lab can run concurrently at any given point in time. How long can that copy of the lab actually run from? These are all kind of characteristics of the cloud. And then depending on what it is, it may be, you know, maybe it's an authenticated cloud, draw a little key right there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's an authenticated cloud. So maybe in order to, you know, for the person to start the lab, they first got to do some sort of authentication process. The VLABs are not authenticated.
Okay.
So then in terms of the actual underlying implementations, so this is our software that defines all this. This is the software we call Hull System. Right? Mm-hmm. It defines these clouds of capacity and then the constraints around the different clouds.
And those are basically your customer profiles for the type of
exactly
project
right.
they want to kick off.
Yeah, one cloud is the vLabs, and then another cloud is the IT camps that you guys do.
Yep.
And other ones of that nature. So what we'll do next is kind of take a quick look at some of the, I guess, block-level architecture that makes all that possible. So within the deployment side of things, right, how did you actually produce the VM and get the VM running? We have a couple of pieces. So we'll take that same sort of farm of Hyper-V servers here.
And they're just traditional rack-mounted servers that
we use
a variety of different types of manufacturers and stuff?
Pizza box servers.
So one-use
servers, lots of disks, lots of RAM, lots of CPU, because, frankly, they're cheap and easy to make.
Yeah.
Blade centers are great, but there's a bit of complexity involved. So we try to keep it as simple as we can.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have deployment servers. Okay. And the deployment servers contain essentially what is a saved state of a lab environment. So it contains the run state of a lab that we've prepared earlier.
Mm-hmm.
We then have what we call library servers. So these are deployment servers, like I said, these are library servers called NEL. And these contain all the VHD files of the actual labs themselves, VHD or VHDX, the case of R2.
Mm-hmm.
When a request comes into a cloud for a copy of a lab, it actually takes this run state, which might only be, say 2 gigabits based on the size of memory, and it looks at all the servers that are in this farm and uses intelligent placement. It's not VMM's intelligent placement, it's really similar in terms of how it
in
works.
Concept form, yeah.
Yeah, looks at CPU count, looks at number of labs that are running, things of that nature, and goes, okay, this lab should probably go on this server right here. And it then takes all this and basically copies it to that server on the fly, does an import operation, and then starts up the lab. So at that point, this lab is now running on this server down here, and the client UI can connect to those console sessions, and the user gets the lab.
So the safe state is like, it literally is like a save checkpoint of a traditional VM that you would expect on your own local environment.
So, if you want something to compare it to, like a snapshot.
Yeah.
So we're like deploying just the snapshot. Now, we don't actually do that. We have a little bit of a sort of a proprietary way we've figured out to do all of this, but it's, conceptually, it's like taking a snapshot and just deploying just the snapshot and pointing it back to disks that live on shared sand.
So the disks that are the main part of it are the VHD files or VHDX files that are on the library servers
in
basic form?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So you're mashing together a snapshot with a parent VHDX file.
And then linking everything on the fly.
And then restoring the memory state back to the end user, and then basically that is your boom, your state of what the lab happens to be.
Where things are going to get really interesting for you, because I know you, Rick, and I've seen your office, and I saw the thing that was swimming around in your coffee cup. I don't really want to know what it is, but I'm sure you've given it a name. Is on back on the storage end of things, how do we actually read these? And so we've got sort of two flavors of storage. We've got your traditional fiber channel stuff, where we've got scale out file servers that kind of look like this, where we've got a two-node scale-out file server. This is an SOFS, right? And they've got multi-channel SMB 3.0 coming out of them, anywhere from 20 to 40 gigs.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got a heartbeat network that goes between them. And then out of the back of that, we've got a pair of fiber channel switches. And then we've got a series of fiber channel storage arrays ranging in values from some terabytes to lots of terabytes.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got cables that kind of go like this here.
Multiple paths, all sorts of redundant stuff.
And then we've got cables that go like this here.
I like your level of redundancy.
Yeah.
It's very good.
It must be
hard to do cable tracing, though.
You don't want to get me started. and so this is all fine and good. This is all, 8-gig fiber channel team, dual port, multipath, all those buzzwords.
Yep.
And so this is how we've done things for a couple of years now. But we're trying to move away from this model right here because this, this piece right here is just hard.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's nothing wrong with it, but it's kind of hard. We're trying to keep costs down so we can keep your costs down and keep our level of flexibility up. So we're now moving to this model of using these cluster in a box enclosures,
okay,
where we take all of this right here and it just comes in the box, right? And so same basic principle. It's just there's no fiber cabling you've got to do on the back end. So we use a combination of these traditional scale. First of all, scale file servers for everything. We don't attach fiber channel anywhere.
Yeah, the Hyper-V boxes are just using SMB3 to be able to talk to the storage.
Yeah, if we were doing fiber channel all the Hyper-V boxes, it'd be
times however many hosts you happen to have.
I could sit here for 5 minutes and just do this. I would not want to do that. And then
so you're going CIB route, cluster
CIB,
in a box route.
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, instead we have just a 2U unit with two cluster nodes, node one, node two, and then that's the front side, and the back side of it is all just disks.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no cable to run at all. It's fantastic. And we just slot these in like, you know, just like pizza boxes. Each one of these costs about $30 data center. About a data center dollar.
I have no idea what data center.
Data center dollars, $2,000.
$2,000?
$2,000. That's a data center dollar.
It's a good exchange rate.
It's
better exchange rate than Canadian American.
Well, it's the minimum you spend if you do anything in a data center. No matter what you do in a data center, it's at least $2,000.
Okay.
So we talk in terms of data center dollars. It just makes it easier to swallow.
I like that.
So, you know.
Now, scale wise on this,
switches are only a couple of bucks.
Okay, so but this guy here, when he fills up, capacity wise, you just buy another CIB.
Yeah,
and then
absolutely.
He simply adds it in as another storage resource.
Yeah, which
that
you know,
then your software goes in and knows where to find stuff.
Right.
Basically,
it's just another path where that it can use to find stuff and use stuff. That's all it is, right? And then the cool thing is because what we've got back here, if you think about, you know, someone who's doing a lab, right? You've got this VHD file. If you think about someone who's doing a lab, they're doing the same stuff over and over and over and over again all the time, which mm-hmm. means that they're probably only hitting the top 10% of the blocks that are in the VHD.
Right,
and so. If only there were a technology to make the top 10% run a whole lot better.
I seem to think that there's a solution for that.
Tiering, storage tiering. So we leverage storage tiering with Windows Server 2012 R2. Now, prior to 2012 R2, we were, you know, in our high-end SAN enclosures, we were buying essentially hardware-based storage tiering. So you get a mm-hmm. mix of SSD hard drive, and the SAN takes care of it all.
Yeah.
We were able to cut a lot of costs by going to these cluster-in-a-box enclosures, mix of SSD hard drive, implementing the tiering, implementing deduplication, and letting that run. And that's just been working out real well for us. So, you know, it's really custom-built to take advantage of all those cool things.
I'm curious, with your cluster-in-a-box devices, you're going with, I'm assuming, 24 disks? You're going with 60 disks? What kind of data center cluster box design?
We've kind of got two of them that are fairly standard. When I say standard, in fact, we've just bought like the second and third one. So
okay.
they're going to be. One of them is a 2U with 12 disks plus a 24-disk JBOD attached to it.
Okay.
And another is a 72-disk with, I think, 12 SSD, and the rest are spinning disk, and that's 4U, I believe.
Okay.
That one's a lot larger, so it's used for the bigger base PHD files, and then the smaller ones are used for the run states as a quick thing to copy off of.
And so, curiosity, what style and size of hard drives and SSDs are you using in those types of enclosures?
I don't know.
They're like what? Like 300 gig SSDs?
All the SSDs are 1.2 terabytes.
1.2 terabytes SSDs. Enterprise grade, obviously. They're not the ones you just go down to Fry's
exactly
and pick up.
Exactly right. So, you know, they're like 75 data center cents.
Okay. Sense. And the HDDs, is they 7,200 for capacity, or are they 10,000 or 1,500?
They're 10,000 RPM drives, usually about 2 terabytes. They're about 10 data center cents a piece.
Mm-hmm.
The entire array is, you know, a couple bucks.
I love the data center dollars.
It's easier to swallow, right?
I love those
data center dollars. You know, because you don't want to go from SSD to 700 RPM. There's a significant IOP difference, so you take a bit of a penalty there. Like the difference between slow and fast is big, and you can get some inconsistency.
Mm-hmm.
But going SSD to 10K, it's not nearly as bad.
Okay.
And so the switch between is a lot better. Since we found that's kind of a good sweet spot. You pay a little bit, and you know the drives a little more expensive. The size are a little bit smaller, but it's a good sort of mix and balance.
And this obviously is a way that you're able to go off and expand to future capacity as you need to,
right.
Because your architecture is simply, okay, we'll just buy another CIB and plug it in.
It's just another file share, right? Just another file share. So we're just adding file shares to the network, and that's each file share represents a storage location.
Now, do you have to worry about the naming, not naming convention, but the namespace of all the file shares everyone's looking at? Or is it simply a matter of that's handled by the logic of your software?
That in our software, it's just another file share. Just add another file share in, and it's good to go. So
okay.
We're not in the DFS or things like that. I'm, you know, keep it simple. KISS principle, keep it simple.
Mm-hmm. Biggest change that's happened in your environment is the advent of bringing these types of CIBs in, or
that's
going 10 gig Ethernet, or Mellanox controllers.
We were 10 gig before it was cool to be 10 gig. we were 10 gig when the cards were so new they were melting every other day.
Oh, nice.
And you think I'm kidding? I've got a box in my home not my bedroom closet, my storage closet upstairs in my house, with what at the time was 40 grand worth of 10 gig Ethernet cards.
Yep.
That were generation one. The fans were too small, so the cards kept melting.
Oh.
And so they replaced them all, and they said, what do you want to do with these? We don't care. We don't want them back. So
nice.
They're great, you know, they're dev servers and stuff.
Dev.
You know it's eventually going to melt, but you know, you get a couple of weeks out of it. So.
it is.
And so, yeah, like the whole idea of, you know, the cluster in a box becoming more and more mainstream, which simplifies the storage management across the board. So mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of, you know, fiber storage still has its place. We use primarily Dadon for the cluster in a box. Our more advanced storage we use from XIO storage, that stuff is absolutely fantastic. It's fiber channel based, but the enclosures are so healthy, they just don't go down. You don't break them. They're fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
So for a real, you know, we've got, if you think about tiering, we've got like a silver, bronze, gold, platinum sort of tiers of where things live, depending on how old it is, how often it's used, the level of performance it needs. And, you know, the XIO stuff is our, you know, platinum, fastest stuff we can possibly have. And only a little bit of that, and then the gold and the silver where the bulk of everything is, and that's all the CIVs.
Yep.
And that sort of stuff. And then the brown stuff is more of the older, just, you know, iSCSI fiber channel enclosure, 700 RPM drives, cheap and deep, as we call. That's, you know, stuff lives there that, you know, gets access to only every now and then.
What about when you're doing a special event, like an on-site or something like that? How has that changed for you? Because in the past, did you used to bring all this sort of stuff?
Yeah, nothing.
Now you don't even bother bringing it anymore?
Yeah, the internet and connectivity is so good now, it doesn't even matter. We do stuff all over the world all the time every day. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, as long as you've got good connectivity, you're set. Physical location is irrelevant.
And
which begs the question, why am I in Redmond, not home?
Well, because you were here for an event. That's why.
True.
And you wanted to do this, or you thankfully said,
absolutely.
Yes, we'll talk about the architecture that works.
I wanted to see you this way.
You know, it's, what can you say, man? Hanging out in the building nine.
In an awkward couch, just
in front of the lobby of where everyone's walking past us.
Using my cool new Surface 2 tablet, by the way.
You got it.
You can prove the Surface 2.
Because it does the double click on
the think.
Oh, nice.
So
even better. Well, thanks, man. I appreciate you coming out.
Absolutely.
Cheers.
Welcome back. Hope you guys enjoyed that. What'd you think?
It's awesome.
Not bad, eh?
Not bad, eh? Is your husky outside? Did you feed him?
I left him at the igloo today for the slightly Canadian episode of The Edge Show.
Go, Leafs, go!
Leafs. Really?
Yes.
No.
I'm a Toronto boy.
I don't know if I can even work with you anymore.
Oh, jeez.
If you'd like to leave a comment about the show, how we did, what you'd like to talk about, please, by all means, down below, comment area, drop us a comment. We'll get back to you as soon as we can. If you want to send us the old-fashioned email way of commentary and some suggestions on how to look after the show, edge@microsoft.com. Follow
or
us.
The new way, via Twitter, so TNEdge.
You got it. Don't forget that one there. TN Edge. I'm actually Rickster CDN, and you are?
At Wireless Life.
In case you want to get a hold of us. And then finally, hey, come on back next time, and we'll see you for number 84.